Do we have a clicker? I can't. Oh, man, that slows me down. So I'm Ron Turco. I'm actually a microbiologist by training. I came to water via the microbiology route and water quality issues, and then became much more interested in the supply issues and a bunch of other sort of side issues that became involved in Indiana on water planning issues around in Marion County and then the state as a whole. So that's where Kale's knowledge of my behavior comes from. So I took sort of a two-level view of this, sort of a national or regional water issues, the future of water kind of thing, to this talk. And it's pretty wide and pretty narrow in spots. So we'll go with that approach, because that's what I got on the slide deck. So we're good. So water is there. Water's out there. Water's an issue. And water's going to be an issue. And it's not becoming any less of an issue. We have too much. We have too little. So it's it depends on the day of the week. It depends on where you are. So what I hope to come from the talk is that we need to be looking at water slightly different than we have in the past. So, just to set the stage, is that this is the water cycle. This is the world you deal in with water. It moves from oceans across the top into the atmosphere, down the mountains, into your supplies, right? So that's where the hydrology of water. It's a loop. It's a circle. And we sit inside of this. We don't drive this, but we do affect it. Climate change and climate change issues related to warming have affected this tremendously. Put more water in the air, which changes our precipitation patterns. I'll show you a little bit on that, slightly bit on that later. But water is a major, we're a major part of the water cycle is what I'm trying to say. And that's really how we come to this, is we're sort of sitting in this. We deal with this cycle. How much water is on Earth? How much is usable? It's a simple question. There's 10 to the 16th liters of available water out there. 9 times 10 to the 16th liters of available water out there on the planet Earth. Okay? Ever thought of it that way? It's a lot of water, but that's not a lot of water. Compared to the total, it's 1.2% of the world's supply, total water supply. So the available water is actually a small, small, small fraction of what's out there in terms of the total water. So again, we deal with that drinkable side. We deal with that very, very small amount of water that's available to us. So we have to manage it carefully. We have to think about where it goes and how it moves and plays. Why do we care about water? Well, you guys are in the landscape business. Grow some grass, grow some plants, grow some trees, grow stuff, right? Never forget that water is part of that process. And it's not just holding things up. Water is part of the whole chlorophyll world of making carbohydrates, right? So water, you put 12 molecules in, you get 6 back, but those 6 other ones went someplace. They went into biomass. So water is part of the plant growth cycle. And that's another important part of this. This is the part that we deal with on some of the agronomic issues in terms of growing things growing for food, is that this is part of that process as well. It's part of the irrigation process. It's part of anything you do with water, you're basically taking something from that, and you are using that water as part of the energy and food for that plant. So it's an important aspect there. It's a nutrient, if you will, in some ways for the plant. The other thing that I always like to remind people, that the soil is connected to the water. Okay? You think about this for a second. When you manage water, you're managing typically water in soil. And the kind of soil you have and the structure of the soil and the arrangements of the soil, the organic matter content of the soil, the ability, it all affects its ability to hold and supply water back to the plant. And this is something I personally work on. This is a personal research area we do. We look at cover crops and organic matter additions to soil in terms of one of the major aspects being water retention and water holding capacity as an impact point for future soil health and issues there. So water holding in the soil is a major issue. It's a major point in how soils interact in the water cycle. How much water gets held there, how much water can the plant use from that point. So it's a really important thing to remember about water. It's just not what's coming down. It's just not what you're spraying out there. It's also got that component that sits in the soil that the plants actually use. And how that interacts is really, really critical in this process. Question I get all the time is, oh, can't we just make more water? The answer to that is really, no, there's no new water. What we got is what we got. Now, having said that, we can make water. I mean, you make water with desalinization, right? Does anybody want to pay for desalinization? I know, but it's not cheap, is it? And it's not really capable of supplying irrigation demand at a high scale. So these are slightly older numbers, but it's a very expensive process of making, unless you bottle this desal water, then you can make a fortune on it, but you'd be fine then. But if you're trying to use it for general things, it's kind of a tough sell in terms of water. So I always preach the point that there's no new water, there's no water, secret water out there. We're not going to be able to make it cheaply yet, though there are some technologies that suggest we can maybe get a little better price point on desalting water. There's some nanotechnology that's around that looks a little less energy intensive to make water. That's a whole different thing. But there's no new water, and we have to sort of deal with what we got. So there's my statement, and I'll sort of stand by that one. So across the globe, we have all kinds of water situations that are out there. We've got got an arrow. There we go. We've got demand areas in here. We've got all kinds of water in India, China, and those sections that have really, really serious drought issues on a reoccurring basis. They really have, in some cases, if you think about it for a second, really poor soil quality and really poor soil health. So they don't really hold much water. So water they do get goes away quickly, right? They move through or move up, moves out. So there's a huge turnover of that water when they get in the system. It doesn't hang very long. So it's those kind of considerations. Some input terms are low. They don't get a lot of water there. They're very dry areas. You come back out of here to the U.S., and we basically have, again, a pretty readily available across the country water supply in terms of what's out there. Until you take the country apart a little bit, then you start to find out that the water, we are a relatively rich water country, okay, but we have water quality issues inside of our water supply issues, okay? So our water we had the Clean Water Act that's been around for 40 plus years. It's tried to impact on modern life. It's tried to help improve the water that's out there. We still have some issues related to the effective use of water. Now, the thing I get asked all the time, and it's part of what I was talking to Kel about at one point, is that there is not really a U.S. national water policy. How many agencies do you think work with water in the U.S. government? Anybody got a guess? 20. There are 20 agencies that work on water in the U.S. government. Is that a very cohesive voice? No. So there's no national U.S. water policy. There's suggestions, there's ideas, there's sort of implementation across, usually it's at a legal level. EPA sort of handles pollution. USGS will tell you how much water was there or where it's going, those kind of things. But there are no national level real rules on water in the U.S. 20 different federal agencies involved. You throw in states, counties, cities, municipalities, parking lot people. There's multi-tier level of water regulation and water in the United States. So if you look at the U.S., what do you see? You see basically two worlds of water. On the west side of the country, you have inadequate supply. On the right, on the east side of the country, that drawn to that yellow line to the middle, you basically have adequate supply. So you basically have two worlds. And that's really a major issue in U.S. water policy determination. You have the irrigated southwest, west, and you have the sort of sometimes irrigated east. And that makes it very difficult. I serve on a lot of have done some federal panels and review panels and other policy-related things. It gets very confusing with those people when they start talking. You talk western water, you talk eastern water. And there's two different worlds because of the supply availability. So the west is all pretty much an irrigation world, and water questions out there are based around irrigation. You come east, and it's all about getting rid of water most of the time. It's management of runoff and resource that way. So, again, the U.S. is very, very difficult to policy across the whole thing. We're too big. We have too many pieces and parts. We have too many things going on to make it a very simple situation to manage. And, again, if you look at the west, that's 83% of our irrigation is out west. And that's basically, you got 17 states that control most of that. So it's a very complex, very hard to regulate world in terms of water. Freshwater is really, really a valuable resource everywhere you go. And again, from that map before, and I was talking about most of U.S. freshwater withdrawals for agriculture or energy production, 80+% of it. The rest is domestic and industrial use, coming in second. So irrigation in the west or energy formation, energy manufacture is not necessarily a complete use. It's usually passed through, but it does end up often with some kind of contaminant in the water during the process. So that's why it gets a little dicey with energy production.
they add defouling chemicals, and that changes the quality of the water a bit. So again, it's all there in terms of how water runs. So the human water cycle is really where we're sitting. Human activities alter the natural water cycle. You have withdrawals downstream, what was previously upstream. You have water being reused in rivers. You've got all kinds of things going on, circulation, collaboration, interjurisdiction, public health. All this stuff is going on inside of this cycle. I put this picture up. This is not my picture. It's from a textbook called Living in the Environment. And this is basically where water goes now in the United States in a lot of settings, right? So you have these very complex, very non-pristine conditions under which water enters and moves through those kind of situations where you have potential for contamination, you have potential for all kinds of different things going. Rainfall comes in or irrigation comes in. That water, it interacts with all that stuff. So that makes it even more complex in terms of how that water is what it touches and how it moves through that system. So the ways water is contaminated, water supply are well known. Basically, it involves not worrying about the treatment and the flow path. So you can contaminate water pretty easily by having it interact with things you don't want to have it interact, not caring about where it goes, not caring about its behavior, and sort of having an unregulated condition under which you move things around. So there's all kinds of opportunities to cause water to become polluted and have issues downstream from that. So an example would be an algae bloom condition. So eutrophication situations. I have two projects. One deals with nitrogen, the other deals with phosphorus. So the phosphorus is really a sort of a Midwest local situation. We work on Lake Erie issues. And the nitrogen is more of a Gulf of Mexico issue because it's further away. And it all basically relates to algae and excess growth in terms of water supply. This is basically Lake Erie a couple summers ago. The green color is not what you want in terms of impact. And then this is the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico. So this is sort of the scales that we've dealt in over the years in terms of water issues, in terms of pollution. What I really spent some time in the last few years is on regional water planning. And regional water planning is a concept that's not particularly well received in Indiana. It's not something that Indianans, Hoosiers, like to do. But I have worked with a number of groups on regional water planning. Point out to them it has a long history. It goes back to the Romans. They built aqueducts. They supplied water. They basically had massive construction projects. They built things that are still there today that moved water. They managed their regional water supply very interestingly. They also had a water commissioner. And the water commissioner was there to oversee the safety of the public water supply. I think they had some interesting rules back then. Contamination of the water resulted in you being put to death. So that's a pretty quick, pretty easy decision there, right? So don't contaminate the water or we'll probably kill you in some unpleasant manner.
Did they drown?
No, they did not. They usually use other means.
The other thing to think about is, where's regional water? When you guys think of regional water, you think planning, you think Arizona, you think California, you think Utah, you think West, right? It's not the case anymore. Water planning is going on all over this country. Atlanta, for example, big issues in Atlanta with water last few years. They spent a lot of time looking at population growth. Where are things going? What's their supply look like? How can we get water into the city? They spent a ton of money on this. So it's not just a Western, it's not an irrigation thing, it's an everywhere thing. As we look at that magic number of population, and that really is the demand term for all this. And then you get the bottom there, you get these two companies that have a major say-so in what goes on in the Atlanta area, Coca-Cola and Delta. And they basically came back to the Atlanta government, Atlanta government, and said, we want a better water plant, or we're going to leave. They got a better water plant. So they basically wanted water stability. Other places are the same thing. Washington State, Seattle's got a big regional water planning thing going on. Great Lakes area around Lake Erie, it has huge water regional water planning going. Arizona, City of Phoenix, that's easy. They don't have any water. It's easy to plan. We'll get water. We'll put it somewhere. That's the plan there. Texas, Houston, Galveston, they have too much water. The most surprising one to me was Boston. Now, Boston has created a very significant regional water supply plan. Where does the water come from? How does it manage? Where's it getting used? Where's it going? Have a very strong regional planning there in terms of water. So this is where I sort of started from.
I got involved in the Indiana side, in basically Indianapolis, which is where a lot of Indiana lives, is around Indianapolis there. I have a map in a second. And this is sort of sets the background for what we deal with in Indiana. We basically have 38 to 40 inches of rain per year. That actually has been going up. We've up in the 42-inch this year range, I think that's what they're saying. Again, it associates with more water in the atmosphere. We lose most of it to evapotranspiration. We get a little groundwater recharge. We get a lot of discharge. We don't have a lot of storage capacity for water. So that's a real thing there in Indiana. So I got involved with the Indianapolis government group, and they basically sort of look at Indiana, and Indianapolis has these nine counties that surround it, and that's the MSA for around Indianapolis. And we looked at that area about water supply, what's going to happen, where's it going to be, big bunch of discussions, lots of talk about how we're going to handle it. Is it going to be groundwater? Is it going to be surface water? What are we going to do around Indianapolis? Huge number of meetings, lots of upset people, lots of concerns, and lots of governments involved, and people being annoyed, and all kinds of fun stuff. I just would go back to West Lafayette and hide out. It would be great. So if you look down, you kind of drill down into the area around Marion County, which is really where the middle of Indianapolis is. It turns out to be a really bizarre arrangement of private wells and public water supplies, surface water, all these things that no one thought about, no one planned on, no one even knew about. These water supplies that were all over the city. So it turned out to be a very complex environment that resulted in sort of an analysis that occurred in these nine counties to what really is important in those places. And then you look down the road, you spent time, you sort of looked at the time steps involved, what's going to happen, what's happening, the trend lines through time, how are these different counties, and each county then ended up coming up with their own kind of county-level plan for how to handle their water supply. And the real question then was raised was, are we going to create a gigantic central supply for the area, or are we going to let each county sort of handle their own supply? They kind of got a hybrid. They've increased capacity on a couple of the existing water supply sources they have there. They opened up a quarry, and now they're storing some huge volume of water in this quarry. So they basically solved the problem by not creating anything massively new, just creating a better use of some existing infrastructure they had to supply all these different demands. And they also want to push certain kinds of growth into certain counties now. So if they have a high water demanding business, they want to locate them in one of the counties that has better subsurface water supply. They only know that because they went out and did an assessment of the availability of groundwater in those counties. So they jumped around, they went around to different counties, they looked at what's there, and they sort of shuffle things around now among these nine counties to try to understand where the best place to put the different things is. So it's a whole different strategy on water in that area. So the benefits from all this become basically you can avoid water shortages, you can avoid regional economic losses, you can avoid the cost of dealing with short-term drought, which is huge, and you can basically avoid consumer conflict. And you can avoid those dry, wet days that people get really annoyed by in terms of whether you can run the water or not. So again, that's part of the planning process. It sort of brings everybody into the process. You can better understand your resources and your needs if you sort of step back and you start planning these things at the county level. And that's really where all this ended up, down at that level. You get economic benefits. So what came out of this, which was not expected, but we were able then to help create, or they helped create a come to Indiana, come to Indianapolis, we've got water for you PR piece. So basically that's what came out of it. That was not the intention at outset. But that's what became out of it, was that we have water. You have an industry that needs water. We will find you fresh, cold groundwater for what you need. We know where it is. And that basically becomes an economic value. And this came out of the regional planning process. So it's really a secondary benefit, but it's really a very big thing. We have also had, we know where the best water supplies are, best locations to protect, and best way to avoid conflict now because of the planning that occurred at the county level across these nine counties. So it was like at the county level, but it was sort of unified across all these counties. Now, will it hold up for long periods of time? Who knows? But we do know that the the benefits were really good. It sort of stopped some wild speculation on what was going on. For example, there was a discussion about building a pipeline from basically the Wabash River to Indianapolis. It's 66 miles of pipeline. And that was the plan that was out there. That plan was crazy because it was a little expensive, but that was a round of the plan, and we sort of shut that down with some of these discussions about availability. Actually, there's quite a bit of availability in that area. So then you get into these water use issues that we brought up all the time. We looked at basically soil moisture, rainwater conditions. So it's a bit of an under-researched area, so we talked about how we could better understand that. We looked at short-term, long-term scales of irrigation, combinations with rainwater, some discussion of that, which we don't do any kind of water recycling use in Indiana. There's no gray water irrigation in Indiana. So it's actually illegal, I think, still, isn't it, gray water? It's a weird rule that we're still trying to work around. But then we looked at some state water stuff in terms of quality of discharge water. And then, again, we keep bringing up this full potential for water reuse as a thing. So the future is really kind of unclear still in some things. So you got to set the realistic expectations of the supply. That's where this thing in Indianapolis really helped me understand that, was that not every county is the same. Their capacities are different. What they can do in those locations is different. Not everybody can have a food processing plant that's going to demand X millions of gallons of water a day. And you can't really go out and recruit for those kind of things if you don't have the supply and can't show that supply. So that's really one of the outcomes from this, was that we had a much better map of accelerated supply, what the realistic expectations of the supply are. And it was really pretty, that was pretty efficient as a tool. We've basically been able to use some of that for accelerated modeling. We've done a lot with education on water cycle. That's been a fun thing. And we keep coming back to the soil tie with water. That's actually helped us in the agricultural world with questions on cover crops and trying to get better water protection that way. So it's all been sort of looping back on it in a good way. And so, again, sort of wrap up here on this, but the overall policy is local. And if you try, we don't have a national policy. We're never going to have a national policy, in my opinion. It's never going to happen. We're going to have states, maybe sort of larger district areas. It's going to come down to counties and cities at that level. I mean, that's really where your water policy is going to come from. You're going to have basically drainage and irrigation districts. They're going to be really where you need to be looking and acting. And so you need to act at the local level, and then you need to think about your flow path for your meetings, your flow path for your water. All of it's about where things are going, the sort of the water potential in the system. So I never thought, when I left grad school a long time ago, I took a couple of irrigation classes. I mean, just for whatever reason, I have no idea. I was a microbiologist. I took irrigation classes. One was an undergrad, one was a grad student. I just liked water. I thought it was a very interesting material. And it turned out to be very valuable later on, but your career kind of does weird flips and turns, where you suddenly are doing water management planning as a faculty member at a university and you're a microbiologist. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but you can help these people understand what they need to do. You can help them on the quality side. That's where I sort of stayed mostly. I was talking about microbial issues and management there, but it really was a very interesting process of learning how water policy does and doesn't exist in the U.S. and how it really is a local thing. And with that, I will probably be over time and stop right there.